director was Ned Shaye.
You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Okay, now on 4 Extra, we've Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education, the second volume of memoirs from the author Brian Thompson. Growing up in the 1950s, Brian charts his erratic journey towards adulthood, beginning with a waltz and an invitation to tea. The reader is David Troughton.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
In 1952, my father Bert came home on a weekend visit to Cambridge and, as they used to say in those days, issued a brief communique. In a month's time, we would all be living in Waltham Cross, 11 miles north of London. For my mother, myself and my six-year-old brother Neil, the news came as the equivalent of being told that he, finally tiring of us, had taken up the life of the circus. His intentions were quite the opposite. This was to be a grand reunion of a family that had not lived together since 1940, during which time the language of love had grown decidedly rusty. Since the end of the war, my father had lived and worked in London, leaving us to slog it out in Cambridge. It was a solution to his sense of outrage at my mother's romantic adventures with the US 8th Air Force, though he might have been surprised at how little she seemed to remember those giddy days. Going with Yanks, as everybody described it in the 1940s, had at least given her something to look forward to in a dull week. When the Americans left, they took her sense of self-worth with them. She drooped. Peace had improved my father's standing greatly. Only a month or so before, he had come home and boasted that he was now on a salary of £1,000 a year. We were in the kitchen when he made the announcement, at which I let it be known that anyone who earned £20 a week was surely acting against the interests of those worse off. He cuffed me to the floor. "You have never earned a penny in your life." "That doesn't make me wrong," I shouted from the lino. "I've worked damn hard since I left the RAF. That counts for nothing, apparently." It was not my father's nature to reveal his deeper feelings. That way lay weakness. But there was something raw in this remark that made me wince. We were strangers to each other, of course, as unlike as chalk and cheese, but I realised with a horrible admission of guilt that I was a sorry disappointment to all he held dear. Before the war, he had been a telephone linesman, hanging from poles by a leather strap, and his cocky stubbornness seemed to be saying, "Look at me now." Staying on at school in the sixth form, reading a load of silly bloody books, did not count. Buying a house was an outward sign of Bert's new status, and it may also have been a gesture of reparation. If that were so, it failed spectacularly. We were all dumbfounded. We had no idea where Waltham Cross was. He pointed his cigarette at me. "Get yourself up to the council offices or wherever you have to go, and find yourself a school locally." "But I'm halfway through the sixth form syllabus here. What's that got to do with it?" My mother returned to the more pressing question. "I will ask you once again," she said with her most dangerous silky emphasis. "Where is this effing dump?" "There's a grammar school in Cheshunt. It's coeducational," said the young official at the education department. "There's an all-boys school in Hartford. I'll take it." When I walked out, my girlfriend, Figgy, greeted me as though I'd just signed up for a 10-year hitch with the Foreign Legion. "How are we ever going to stay together now?" she wailed. Waltham Cross in the 1950s was drear. Our place in this shapeless dormitory was on an estate of post-war housing drabbling to the railway line. My father had bought a stake in this paradise at the controlled figure of £1,650, a figure that stays in the mind because so often repeated. The houses were ridiculously small. When the four of us sat at table, it was impossible to open the drawers to the new sideboard. We carried on the working-class tradition of making the front room the best room. There were no welcoming hearths. Instead, in each of the ground-floor rooms was a 2-bar electric fire fitted flush to the wall. In cold weather, in addition to the smell of convected dust, came the sharp and warning tang of wood varnish heated to flashpoint. In this new life, my father walked to the station every day with selected cronies, all adepts of the Daily Telegraph crossword and the homelier parts of the home service. My new school in Hartford was a 40-minute bus ride away. I was the furthest flung of its students. Standing at the bus stop the first time that I took the journey to school, I was the only youth in the queue. I stood there with my hands in my pockets, gazing down at what were called in those days brothel creepers, brown shoes with massive crepe soles. To kill time waiting for the green double-decker, I rolled a cig and recombed my hair. A little beyond Chesant, a plumply confident boy clattered upstairs wearing a blazer with the school crest. His name was John Tidyman, and in later life he went on to become a distinguished radio producer. At Hartford, he walked me to our destination, a foundation grammar school created a year after Shakespeare's death. Housed since 1930 in a handsome brick building, it exuded, as I saw it, class. Waiting to one side was the senior English master. Andrew Wilkinson was such a teacher as I had not previously met, good-natured, effortlessly scholarly, and a brilliant educator. We went to an empty classroom to discuss how to adapt what little I knew to what I was to study. "Have you read any modern poets, for example?"
"No."
"What do you think about the whole idea of modernity?" "Do you like jazz?" I countered. "That might be a way of getting to the question. Do you think you could write me a piece saying what people mean when they talk about modern jazz? What they're trying to indicate by the adjective?" He had me hooked. "You've changed," my mother said. "It happens every morning, soon as I walk out of this door." It was a cruel and unnecessary thing to say. The best judge of how much I had changed was Figgy. I went back to Cambridge a few times to see her, and we spent our days together in greasy spoon cafes and cinemas. She told me about Mr. Kitto, the office manager at work. I told her about Blake seeing angels roosting in the trees.
"What a snob you are,"
she retorted, as we said goodbye on the London platform one Sunday night.
"You don't mean that. It's like Ian says, you're still only a schoolboy."
"Who's Ian?" I asked, feeling my heart plummet.
"Someone I know."
The white of her blouse shone like magnolia.
"I love you,"
I said, maddened by grief. She turned and ran. But she was right. Only a little educational encouragement had turned me from a wolf in the forest to a half-formed swot. Tidyman was sympathetic.
"Isn't education supposed to subvert who you were before you started out on it?"
"What do you want to do with your life?" I asked.
"Go to Cambridge, I think. Then Italy. Read. Wilkinson thinks you are something special, by the way."
My usual Saturday night pleasures were taken with a loose gang of tearaways. In November, we assembled at a church hall on the Enfield Highway for a dance. I was wearing the brown zoot suit that had bowled Figgy over in her day, set off by yellow socks and a gold-knitted tie. On my feet were the infamous brothel creepers. There were no more than 40 people present, and the waltz was taken up by what seemed to me elderly couples. There was one exception. Two girls danced together, for want of a partner of their own age.
I walked the slim one home. Like me, she was still at school. One of my father's first acts of improvement to his new property was to relay the lawn, watched covertly by Alf next door. For Alf, the lawn was somewhere for his kids to play and his wife to hoist the washing line. We too had a washing line, but it was not allowed to cross the sacred rectangle that my father was preparing to seed. Our lawn was laid on crushed clinker and built up from riddled soil skimmed from the rest of the garden. When finished, it became a tourist attraction. Neighbours walking along the cinder track at the rear of the properties would pause and stare. The great lawn of Waltham Cross was my father's contribution to the upward mobility of the neighbourhood. When he began to build a glazed lean-to, we had, so to speak, arrived. Some of the materials for the lean-to came from a builder's yard where the mystery girl's father worked. His name was George, a short, barrel-chested man with a shy smile. S, the girl from the dance, was an only child. Her dark hair was cut short, framing a snub-nosed face. When she laughed, she doubled over, but her default expression was a chin-up and faintly challenging briskness. Invited to tea one Sunday, I found the family had a piano that no one could play and a flatulent old dog called Mick. George had a garage at the end of the garden and had recently moved up from a motorcycle and sidecar to a pale green Hillman. They ate proper breakfast, this family, had weekend lunch with real cuts of meat, and on Sunday afternoon splashed out with cake and a tin of peaches, soused in carnation milk.
"It was so bloody wonderful round our house. Go and live there,"
my mother encouraged me.
"See if I give a bugger."
It was tempting. Vi was as tall as George was short. An essential shyness made her talk too much, a garrulity he good-naturedly abridged. But on the other hand, they did talk to each other. S was a wonder to them, dutiful, horribly bright, and more socially confident than both of them put together. Like me, she had 10 O-levels, and like my parents, hers were having the greatest difficulty in understanding what that signified. It was Vi's opinion that for her daughter to go to university was out of the question. That would be for the family to overreach. In that fatally damaging phrase, they knew their place, these two quiet people. It must have seemed extraordinary to them that of all the young men she might have met, S had brought home such a badly drawn sketch of a university place seeker, half yob, half swat, a boy who rolled his own cigarettes and was rendered speechless by Battenberg cake. It never once entered their minds that their child was just as intelligent, rather better educated, and twice as sane.
In the next episode, we go back to the days of national service training. Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education by Brian Thompson and abridged by Doreen Estill was read by David Troughton. The producer was Amber Barnfather.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and welcome. It's Alan Smith with you here on 4 Extra, where we're about to indulge ourselves in an hour of drama and the next part of No Name by Wilkie Collins. That's next. And if comedy's your thing, make sure you round off the day with Diane Morgan at the Comedy Club, which tonight opens with the teams being given some silly things to do in I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. That and the Comedy Club are all at 10. So, it's time for drama now on 4 Extra and part 6 of No Name by Wilkie Collins, which finds Mrs. LeConte setting to work on her elaborate plan.
No Name by Wilkie Collins, dramatised by Ray Jenkins, with Sophie Thompson as Magdalen Vanston, Jack May as Captain Ragg, Eleanor Bronn as Mrs. LeConte, and Nigel Anthony as Noel Vanston. Episode 5, August 1847. Magdalen Vanston is about to marry her cousin, Noel Vanston, who believes her to be called Susan Bygrave and no relation. The deceit is being perpetrated because Magdalen is seeking to win back her inheritance, which has gone to Noel Vanston on the discovery of the illegitimacy of Magdalen and her sister.
I beg your pardon, miss. I think Mr. Bygrave told me the marriage was...